Okay, let's set the stage. You walk into your patient's room, and the cardiac monitor is just screaming at you. You see these textbook peaked T waves.
Yep. Tall, narrow, they just look dangerous.
Exactly. And the patient is telling you they feel this profound generalized muscle weakness, and you know from their chart they're in end-stage renal failure.
So what's your immediate life-saving concern? I mean, this isn't just a question about electrolytes. It's a priority question. And the critical follow-up, what single medication must you prepare and administer first to prevent an immediate cardiac arrest?
That is the ultimate hyperkalemia nightmare scenario. And here's the crucial insight, and this is what we're all about today. The very first intervention isn't about aggressively lowering the potassium.
Not at all. It's about stabilizing the heart cell membranes to buy yourself time.
That essential priority response, knowing the difference between saving the heart and just, treating a lab value, that's the mission for today's deep dive.
Welcome back to ConceptCast, brought to you by Nursing Notes. We are your audio mentors, and today we aren't just summarizing facts. We are distilling the high-yield, life-saving knowledge you need to master physiological adaptation.
This is, hands down, the largest and most critical section of the NCLEX exam. It demands critical thinking and priority setting above, well, above everything else. We've pulled together these complex conditions that all share a common thread.
They do. It's breakdowns in the body's ability to manage perfusion and acid-base balance.
Right. And if you can understand those two pillars, you can really answer almost any question they throw at you in this domain.
Exactly. Our goal today is to look for the patterns, the red flag findings, and the absolute priority nursing actions that separate the successful candidate from those who get tripped up by those tricky distractors.
We're focusing on how to make these complex multi-system concepts instantly recognizable and, immediately actionable in any exam scenario.
Let's do it.
We're kicking off our review of what we're calling the big four conditions that really dominate this physiological adaptation domain. They all represent chronic illnesses where the body's compensation mechanisms are, well, they're failing. So let's start with the lungs and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, COPD.
Right. When you think COPD, you have to define it really quickly in your head. It's progressive and it's irreversible airflow limitation. That's the core of it.
And that covers both chronic bronchitis and emphysema.
Yeah, it does. You have chronic bronchitis, which is the classic blue bloater that's all about inflammation and just tons of mucus. And then you have emphysema, the pink puffer, which is defined by the actual destruction of the alveolar walls. The elastic recoil is just gone.
And all of that leads to the central problem, which is air trapping.
Yes. The air gets in just fine, but the damaged airways collapse when they try to exhale, so the CO2 can't get out. This causes hyperinflation of the lungs, and it forces the patient to work exponentially harder just to breathe.
So clinically, what are the high-yield assessment findings for an NCLEX scenario? What should you be looking for?
You're looking for the physical signs of that chronic struggle to breathe. So, the barrel chest. That's from the chronic hyperinflation. And you'll see the patient using their accessory neck
Or
muscles.
you can see them straining.
You really can. And crucially, you'll notice a prolonged expiration. They are physically pushing air out against a collapsing airway. And if the disease has been going on for a long time, you might see that classic clubbing of the fingers.
Which is just a key sign of chronic hypoxia.
Exactly.
Okay, let's talk about management. If you get a question asking for the single most effective intervention to, actually alter the course of the disease, what is that cornerstone?
It is always unequivocally smoking cessation. That is the only intervention that's been proven to slow down the relentless progression of COPD. We can manage symptoms with bronchodilators and steroids, sure, but quitting smoking actually changes the trajectory of the disease.
Okay, but here's the trap. This is where NCLEX loves to get you. Oxygen therapy. We're all taught, if the SpO2 is low, you give oxygen. So why is too much supplemental O2 so dangerous for a certain subset of patients with advanced COPD, the chronic CO2 retainers?
This is a really deep conceptual point. For you and me, the primary drive to breathe is triggered by high CO2 levels in our blood. Our body says, hey, too much acid building up, breathe faster, get it out.
Right.
But if a patient chronically retains CO2 because their gas exchange is so poor, their respiratory center in the brain basically resets. It stops relying on CO2 as the trigger. Their primary drive to breathe actually shifts to low oxygen. We call it the hypoxic drive.
So if you come in and aggressively flood their system with high flow oxygen, you're basically knocking out that hypoxic stimulus entirely.
Precisely. You take away the only remaining chemical trigger that's telling them to take a breath. And then what can happen is they reduce their respiratory rate or their effort, and that leads to profound CO2 accumulation, sliding them right into acute respiratory acidosis.
So the nursing action is to be cautious.
Extremely cautious. You titrate it to maintain NSpO2 generally between, say, 88% and 92%. You use the lowest effective dose, and you monitor for signs of increased CO2 retention, like lethargy or new confusion.
And beyond oxygen, let's talk about some practical nursing interventions. Pursed lip breathing is essential, but I think a lot of students forget why it actually works.
It's like engineering your own expiration. By forcing the air out slowly through pursed lips, you create a little bit of back pressure inside the airways.
A little positive pressure.
Exactly. A tiny bit of positive pressure that acts like a splint. It prevents those small bronchioles from collapsing too early. This prolongs the expiration, and that allows more of that trapped CO2 to actually leave the alveoli.
So you teach the patient to breathe in slowly through the nose and then exhale slowly through pursed lips, making the exhale about twice as long as the inhale.
That's the technique.
And finally, nutrition. The sheer effort of breathing. It's a huge metabolic drain.
Oh, huge. They are burning hundreds of extra calories a day just trying to move air. And they're often too tired or too short of breath to even eat a full meal. The malnutrition that results just makes their prognosis worse.
So what's the nursing recommendation there? It's pretty critical.
Small, frequent meals. They have to be high in calories and especially high in protein because that helps rebuild the muscle mass they're losing from that catabolic state. And you want to avoid foods that cause a lot of gas or bloating.
Right, because a distended abdomen is just going to push up on the diaphragm and make breathing even harder.
Exactly.
Okay, now let's shift from the failing lungs to the failing pump, congestive heart failure, or CHF. The big concept here is that the heart just can't keep up with the demands, and that leads to fluid backing up. NCLEX always, always requires you to differentiate the symptoms based on where the failure is.
Yeah, you have to use geography here. If the left side of the heart fails, that's the side that pumps oxygenated blood out to the body. Where does the pressure back up?
It backs up into the lungs.
Exactly. Think L for left, L for lungs.
So, left-sided failure presents with purely pulmonary congestion. We're looking for dyspnea, difficulty breathing when lying flat, orthopnea. We even measure it by the number of pillows they need to sleep.
Mm-hmm. And you listen for those classic pulmonary crackles or rails. In really severe cases, the patient might even cough up pink, frothy sputum, which is a huge red flag for pulmonary edema.
So conversely, if the right side fails, that's the side that receives deoxygenated blood from the body, where does that blood back up?
It backs up into the rest of the body. The systemic venous circulation. So the physical assessment findings are completely different. You're looking for peripheral edema, pitting edema, often worse at the end of the day.
And marked jugular vein distension, or JVD.
Yes. And abdominal swelling, which is ascites, and potentially an enlarged liver or spleen, hepatomegaly.
This distinction is just so crucial for the test. If you see a patient with JVD and ascites, you have to immediately think right-sided failure. If they have orthopnea and crackles, you're thinking left-sided. So what are the nursing priorities, especially when it comes to fluid?
Managing that fluid overload is priority number one. And here's a critical high yield point. While we measure INO and we check lung sounds, the single best and most reliable measure of fluid status is daily weights.
It's not the edema.
It is not the edema. You have to weigh the patient at the same time every day, using the same scale, wearing the same type of clothes. A weight gain of 2 to 3 pounds or more overnight is the earliest sign of fluid retention. It often shows up before you can hear noticeable crackles or see pitting edema.
And the medication management for this ties directly back to electrolytes, primarily with loop diuretics like furosemide.
Right, and these are crucial for pulling off fluid volume quickly, but they are potassium wasting.
Yeah.
So the nursing responsibility is to anticipate and prevent hypokalemia, low potassium.
And that's even more dangerous if the patient is also on digoxin.
Oh, absolutely. Digoxin is used to strengthen the heart's contraction, but hypokalemia dramatically increases the risk of developing life-threatening digoxin toxicity. The signs can be kind of vague GI distress, seeing yellow halos in their vision, but the danger is deadly dysrhythmias. You have to constantly monitor those CUD levels and supplement as ordered.
Okay, now we move to the ultimate filter, the kidneys. If the heart is struggling with CHF, the kidneys are often the next organ to fail because of poor perfusion. So we have to differentiate acute kidney injury, AKI, from chronic kidney disease, CKD.
AKI is sudden, it's often reversible, and it demands immediate attention. We categorize the causes in a way that's brilliant for NCLEX scenarios.
Prerenal, intrinsic, and postural.
Exactly. Prerenal means there's a perfusion issue before the kidney, like severe dehydration or shock. Intrinsic means there's direct damage to the kidney tissue itself, maybe from nephrotoxic antibiotics or contrast dye. And postural means there's an obstruction after the kidney, like a huge kidney stone or an enlarged prostate.
And the key clinical sign is oliguria urine output less than 400 millilitres a day.
Right. Along with a rising BUN and creatinine and systemic problems like hyperkalemia and metabolic acidosis.
And then you have CKD, which is the progressive irreversible destruction of the nephrons. It's often a long-term consequence of uncontrolled diabetes or hypertension.
Yeah, CKD leads to the systemic accumulation of waste products. And we use two terms here that students have to differentiate. Azotemia is the lab finding. The BUN and creatinine are elevated. Uremia is when those waste products actually start causing clinical symptoms.
So that's the difference between just having a high lab value and the patient actually feeling sick from it.
Exactly. Uremic symptoms include intense itching, pruritus, nausea, vomiting, and even subtle neurological changes like confusion.
And with CKD, we also see major complications like fluid overload and, critically, anemia.
Anemia is a classic CKD complication. It happens because the damaged kidneys can no longer produce enough erythropoietin, which is the hormone that stimulates red blood cell production in the bone marrow, and that anemia just makes the patient's fatigue so much worse.
So if the filter is failing, what is the nurse's priority management? It seems like it all centers on restriction.
Absolutely. Dietary and fluid management is paramount. We have to restrict protein, not eliminate it, but restrict it because protein metabolism creates that highly toxic nitrogenous waste, the BUN. Too much protein just accelerates the uremia.
We also restrict sodium and fluids pretty aggressively.
Yes, to manage the volume overload and hypertension. And finally, we restrict potassium and phosphate. High potassium is lethal, causing dysrhythmias. And high phosphate is tricky. It leads to bone demineralization because calcium gets pulled out of the bone to bind with all that excess phosphate, leading to weak, painful bones.
So the nursing role is often enforcing these really tough diets and monitoring for complications like that severe itching.
It really is. It requires a lot of patient education and support. Okay, moving to an acute metabolic disaster, diabetic ketoacidosis, or DKA. This is a major NCLEX favorite because it tests complex prioritization and sequencing. DKA is almost exclusively an acute complication of type 1 diabetes.
Right, where a severe lack of insulin forces the body to burn fat for fuel, and that creates these acidic byproducts called ketones.
And the DKA triad is the essential diagnostic snapshot you need to have in your head. It's severe hyperglycemia blood glucose, often over 250 detectable ketosis, with ketones in the blood and urine, and profound metabolic acidosis.
So a low serum bicarbonate and a pH below 7.3.
Exactly. And the precipitating factor is often an infection, a missed insulin dose, or some kind of major physical stress. The manifestations are a picture of severe rapid dehydration and the body desperately trying to compensate for all that acid.
Okay, tell us about that compensation. The Kussmaul respirations.
This is such a deep insight. Kussmaul respirations are deep and they are rapid. This isn't just a patient breathing fast because they're anxious. It's a forced last-ditch physiological attempt to blow off CO2.
Because CO2 dissolves in the blood to become carbonic acid.
Precisely. So by hyperventilating, the patient is trying to reduce their acid load and raise their desperately low pH. Seeing Kussmaul respirations immediately signals critical metabolic distress. Other signs are the polyuria, polydipsia, that profound dehydration, fruity breath odor from the acetone, and often really severe abdominal pain.
The treatment sequence here is absolute priority on the exam. So what is the immediate first action?
IV fluids. That is step one before insulin. The patient is severely volume depleted from the osmotic diuresis caused by all that sugar in their blood. They could be hypotensive, even in hypovolemic shock. You have to correct the dehydration and restore tissue perfusion first, typically with large volumes of normal saline.
Okay, once volume is restored, then we move to step two, the IV insulin infusion.
Right. We administer regular insulin via a continuous IV pump. And crucially, we have to lower the blood glucose gradually. If you drop the glucose too fast, you risk these rapid fluid shifts into the brain, which can cause cerebral edema, a devastating, often fatal complication.
And step three is the electrolyte wild card, potassium. This is where students often get tripped up.
This requires a major aha moment. So when the patient first presents, their serum potassium might actually look normal or even high.
Why is that?
Because the acidosis and the lack of insulin push potassium out of the cells and into the bloodstream. But And this is the key. As soon as you start that insulin infusion, insulin acts like a rapid transport vehicle. It drags glucose and potassium back into the cells.
So if you don't proactively replace the potassium, the patient's serum level is going to crash.
It will crash, resulting in profound hypokalemia and fatal dysrhythmias.
That's the key turning point. The insulin is what causes the shift. So hourly management demands extreme vigilance.
You are monitoring blood glucose, potassium, and their acid-base status every single hour. And once the blood glucose drops to around 250-300, the nurse has to change the IV fluid to something with dextrose in it, like D5W mixed with saline.
Why is that?
To prevent hypoglycemia while still allowing the insulin infusion to keep running, you still need the insulin to clear the ketones and correct the acidosis. That complex balancing act is exactly what the exam tests.
Okay, these next two conditions can kill a patient faster than most chronic diseases. Let's focus on the essential immediate nursing interventions for electrolyte imbalances.
We introduced hyperkalemia in the hook. This is too much potassium levels over 5.0, and it severely compromises cardiac function.
The key clinical features are those ECG alerts. The signature sign is the peaked T wave, often followed by a widened QRS complex. Patients also have that severe muscle weakness and paresthesias. The risk is immediate VFib or cardiac arrest.
The causes are usually tied to decreased excretion. Renal failure is the big one, or medications like potassium-sparing diuretics, or even massive tissue breakdown that releases all that intracellular potassium. But the real high-yield content is the three-step management sequence. It has to be done in order.
What is the immediate first step to stabilize the heart, regardless of what the Q level is?
5-E calcium gluconate. This is a non-negotiable step one. Its purpose is purely to protect the myocardium. It stabilizes the cardiac cell membranes against the electrical irritability caused by the high potassium. But, and this is crucial, calcium gluconate does not lower the potassium level.
It just buys you time.
It buys you about 30 to 60 minutes of protection.
Okay, so step two is shifting that potassium out of the bloodstream and temporarily into the cells.
This is the rapid fix. We use the power duo of IV regular insulin plus IV glucose. The insulin shoves the potassium into the cells rapidly, and the glucose is just there to prevent the resulting hypoglycemia. Another quick-acting agent is sodium bicarbonate, which also causes an intracellular shift by correcting acidosis.
And then the final step is the definitive treatment, elimination.
You have to get it out of the body. If the kidneys are working, we can use loop diuretics. If not, the classic GI medication is sodium polystyrene sulfonate, or chiaxylate. It's an exchange resin that swaps sodium for potassium in the gut, so you excrete the potassium in the stool.
That's slow.
It's very slow. For a critical refractory hyperkalemia, immediate dialysis is the only definitive answer.
Okay, now for the opposite problem. Low calcium, hypocalcemia, so below 8.5. While high potassium stops the heart, low calcium makes the muscles and nerves hyperexcitable.
Right. The clinical features are all focused on that neuromuscular irritability. Tingling, numbness, muscle cramps, and the risk of developing life-threatening laryngospasm and seizures.
And NCLEX absolutely loves the two classic signs that demonstrate that neuromuscular hyperactivity.
Ah.
You have to know these cold.
You do. Shavostic sign is that involuntary twitching of the facial muscles when you tap the facial nerve just in front of the ear. And Trousseau's sign is that painful, characteristic carpal spasm where the hand and wrist flex up awkwardly when you inflate a blood pressure cuff above their systolic pressure for a few minutes.
Common causes are often related to the parathyroid glands, like hypoparathyroidism, which you see a lot after thyroid surgery, or conditions that affect calcium absorption, like a vitamin D deficiency or severe pancreatitis.
The nursing focus, if the calcium is dangerously low, is administering IV calcium replacement, usually calcium gluconate or calcium chloride. But here is the priority action. You must administer IV calcium slowly.
Why slowly?
A rapid infusion can cause severe cardiac dysrhythmias and bradycardia. So we also place the patient on seizure precautions and maintain continuous ECG monitoring. And you always have to ensure the patient's airway is patent because laryngospasm is a very real, very severe risk.
Okay, we're moving into the rapid response, time-critical scenarios. In these emergencies, the nurse has to instantly identify the problem and initiate the protocol.
Let's review the foundation. Basic life support, or BLS. Remember, the ABCs have been reversed to CAD, circulation, airway, breathing. Compressions come first. The quality of your compressions is what matters most for patient survival.
And those quality metrics are crucial for the exam. A compression depth of about 2 inches in adults at a rate between 100 and 120 compressions per minute.
And when the code team arrives, we transition to ACLS Advanced Cardiac Life Support. This involves specific medications, notably epinephrine, which is given for most non-perfusing rhythms, and amiodarone,
which is often used for VFib or pulseless VTach that's refractory to defibrillation.
Exactly. But the nurse's role in a code blue is often overlooked. It's not always about shocking or pushing drugs. It's about organization and communication.
Your ability to recognize the arrest and start CPR is paramount, of course. But once the team is there, your critical task is providing accurate, standardized information during the handoff. This is where SBR really shines.
It does. Situation, background, assessment, recommendation.
Why is SBR so critical in a code?
Because the code leader has to make rapid decisions. You need to tell them the situation. Patient is in VFib, the background. History of severe CHF, just got a dose of furosemide. The assessment. Pupils are fixed, rhythm is VFib, no pulse, and potentially a recommendation. Suggest we use amiodarone per ACLS guidelines. A clear SBR prevents dangerous delays and treatment errors that are caused by disorganized information.
Okay, another emergency. Anaphylaxis. This is a complete physiological shutdown due to a severe allergic reaction. It's defined by two terrifying features: rapid respiratory distress and profound, potentially fatal hypotension leading to shock.
This reaction is mediated by a massive release of histamine, which causes widespread vasodilation that drops the blood pressure, and bronchoconstriction and angioedema, which closes the airway. When you see a scenario describing urticaria or hives, angioedema, stridor, or wheezing, combined with tachycardia and a plummeting blood pressure, you have to think anaphylaxis immediately.
What is the absolute immediate first-line treatment? This is the definition of a priority action.
Epinephrine IM. Nothing comes before this. The dose is usually 0.3 to 0.5 milligrams of a 1 to 1,000 concentration, injected right into the mid-outer thigh.
And what does it do?
It's a powerful alpha and beta agonist. The alpha effect causes immediate vasoconstriction, which stabilizes the blood pressure, and the beta effect causes bronchodilation, opening up the airway. It's the essential physiological antagonist to the effects of histamine.
And once that initial life-saving dose is given, what's the crucial sequence of follow-up actions?
Airway management is still key. So, supplemental oxygen and preparing for a possible intubation. You need IV access immediately to start aggressive IV fluids to counteract the massive vasodilation that caused the hypotension. Then you can give the secondary meds, antihistamines like diphenhydramine to block further histamine release and corticosteroids to prevent a potential delayed or biphasic reaction hours later.
Okay, critical care nursing. This requires technical mastery and meticulous vigilance. Let's focus on two areas that always come up on the NCLEX: mechanical support.
Starting with mechanical ventilation, you really need to understand the language of the vent. FiO2 is just the percentage of oxygen the patient is receiving. Tidal volume, or V8, is the volume of gas delivered with each breath, and we typically keep that low to avoid lung injury. But the most important setting to grasp conceptually is PEEP.
Positive end expiratory pressure. Why is PEEP so critical?
PEEP maintains a positive pressure in the lungs at the very end of expiration. The best way to think about it is that it's splinting the alveoli open. It prevents those tiny air sacs from collapsing entirely. This increases the functional residual capacity, and critically, it improves oxygenation by recruiting more lung surface area for gas exchange.
Okay, let's troubleshoot the alarms. This is a classic NCLEX scenario. The ventilator is alarming. What do you do?
First rule is always assess the patient, not the machine. But if the machine is the issue, you have to differentiate. A high-pressure alarm means there's an obstruction preventing the breath from getting into the lungs easily.
So your first thought is the patient biting the tube? Is the tubing kinked?
Exactly. Are they coughing or gagging, creating internal resistance? If the quick fixes don't work, you have to listen to their lung sounds for secretions that need suctioning, or in the worst-case scenario, you have to assess for a pneumothorax.
At a low-pressure alarm.
That means there's a disconnection or a leak somewhere in the system. The air that's supposed to be delivered isn't reaching the patient, so you check all the connections. Is the tubing disconnected from the patient? Is the cuff deflated, allowing air to leak out? The real danger here is loss of ventilation and a silent airway emergency.
The ultimate gold standard in ventilator management, the non-negotiable bundled intervention, is VAP, prevention ventilator-associated pneumonia. This is a multi-step checklist that saves lives.
This bundle has to be ingrained in your brain. Four key elements. First, keep the head of bed elevated 30 to 45 degrees. This simple intervention significantly reduces the risk of aspiration.
Okay, that's number one.
Second, meticulous oral care with chlorhexidine, and you do it frequently, every 2 to 4 hours, to reduce the bacterial load in the mouth. Third, subglottic sectioning, which is a specialized port that lets you section secretions that pool above the cuff of the endotracheal tube.
And fourth,
implementing sedation vacations when possible. This allows the nurse to assess the patient's neurological status and their readiness to wean from the ventilator.
Let's talk about a tracheostomy. It's a secure airway, but it requires sterile, precise care to prevent infection and manage emergencies.
Right. The basic care involves cleaning the stomacyte with sterile saline, changing the track ties or holder, and making sure the stoma area is clean and dry.
And the suctioning technique is really high yield. We need to remind everyone about the sterile technique and the timing.
It is a sterile procedure from start to finish. You always, always pre-oxygenate the patient with 100% oxygen for about 30 seconds to a minute before you start. You insert the suction catheter gently until you meet resistance or the patient coughs, and you do not apply suction while you're inserting it.
The crucial rule is to suction only while withdrawing the catheter.
Yes, using a gentle rotating motion, and you limit the entire suction pass to under 10 seconds. Any more time or too much negative pressure can cause hypoxia and damage the tracheal mucosa.
Okay, the bedside emergency kit. This is key for managing an accidental decannulation scenario.
Right.
What three things must be physically at the bedside for every single tracheal patient?
One, the obturator. This is that rigid, rounded guide that you use to reinsert the tube if it comes out. Two, a spare track tube of the exact same size. And three, a spare track tube of the next size smaller.
Why the smaller one?
Because if the patient's stoma is swelling or the anatomy is just difficult, that smaller tube might be the only one you can successfully place to secure the airway quickly until a definitive airway can be reestablished.
And the complication alerts. What should we be feeling for?
Beyond infection and bleeding, the high alert complication is subcutaneous emphysema. This is air leaking from the trachea into the tissue underneath the skin. When you palpate the neck and chest, it feels like crunchy rice cereal.
Crepitus?
Yes, crepitus. This is an immediate warning sign that the airway is compromised and it needs an urgent evaluation.
Okay, this next section ties together everything we've been talking about. Perfusion, fluid balance, acid base, because sepsis and multi-organ dysfunction syndrome, or MODS, are the result of a catastrophic systemic failure.
Right. Sepsis begins with an infection that leads to this systemic inflammatory response, causing widespread vasodilation and capillary permeability. This results in global poor tissue perfusion.
And if that patient then develops persistent hypotension, even after you give them adequate fluids and their serum lactate levels are high, they've crossed the line into septic shock,
which is a severe failure of the circulatory system to deliver oxygen. The management has to be executed rapidly, and it's often summarized as the sepsis bundle. Let's break down that critical management triangle.
It's aggressive and it's time sensitive.
Absolutely. First, aggressive 5E fluid resuscitation, usually with crystalloids like normal saline or lactated ringers, to counteract that massive vasodilation and hypotension. Second, you have to draw blood cultures to identify the causative organism. But, and here's the test track, you must initiate broad-spectrum IV antibiotics after those cultures are drawn, but without waiting for the results.
Any delay in antibiotics dramatically increases mortality.
It does. And if the hypotension persists despite all the fluids, then you escalate to the third step. That's when we initiate vasopressors, typically norepinephrine or Levofed. This drug constricts those vasodilated blood vessels, which increases systemic vascular resistance and raises the mean arterial pressure to drive blood flow to the vital organs.
So the nursing focus here is just constant surveillance. What are the key metrics that truly tell the nurse if the resuscitation efforts are working?
Lactate clearance and urine output. Lactate is the metabolic byproduct of anaerobic metabolism. It means the tissues are literally starving for oxygen. So if the lactate level is high and it's not clearing, your perfusion is still inadequate.
And urine output is a direct, visible proxy for kidney perfusion.
Exactly. If the patient isn't producing at least 0.5 milliliter per kilogram per hour of urine, they are in acute renal failure due to poor circulation, and your resuscitation efforts need adjustment. And of course, maintaining strict asepsis is paramount to prevent any further complications.
We end our core content with the two conditions NCLEX uses constantly to test your understanding of adrenal hormone balance. Addison's disease, which is adrenal insufficiency, versus Cushing's syndrome, which is glucocorticoid excess. We need a definitive conceptual comparison.
We can summarize this whole relationship with extremes. Addison's means you are missing both cortisol, the stress hormone, and aldosterone, the salt and fluid hormone. Cushing's means you have way too much cortisol.
Okay, let's look at Addison's first. Since both hormones are low, you can think of the clinical picture as down, 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 up.
Everything is depressed. The patient is weak, fatigued. They have weight loss. Most critically, their blood pressure is low hypotension. And because aldosterone is deficient, the body aggressively wastes sodium and fluid.
Which leads to hyponatremia.
Yes. And conversely, it retains potassium, leading to hyperkalemia. This explains why patients with Addison's frequently crave salty foods.
And what's the classic visual cue that really sets primary Addison's apart?
The hyperpigmentation, or that bronze-colored skin and the darkening of scars. This happens because the pituitary gland is desperately trying to stimulate the adrenal gland by producing large amounts of ACTH, and a byproduct of ACTH production is a hormone that stimulates melanin.
So the management is all about replacing the deficit.
Right. It's a lifelong process. Hormone replacement hydrocortisone for cortisol and fludrocortisone for aldosterone. Key nursing teaching points include the need to increase salt intake as directed, especially during heat or stress, and the critical need for stress dosing.
So taking higher doses of hydrocortisone during an illness or surgery.
Exactly, to prevent acute adrenal failure. The nursing vigilance is really focused on preventing the Addisonian crisis, which is acute adrenal failure leading straight to circulatory shock.
Okay, so Cushing's is the polar opposite. Excess glucocorticoids, often caused by chronic steroid use for things like asthma or rheumatoid arthritis, or sometimes by an adrenal tumor. If Addison's is down, Cushing's is up, 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 down. Everything is elevated or centralized.
It is. Cortisol is a catabolic hormone and a fat-depositing hormone. So we see central obesity, the classic moon face, and the buffalo hump on the upper back. Cortisol also increases blood pressure and causes fluid retention, leading to hypertension and hypernatremia.
And because of the mineralocorticoid effect, they also waste potassium, leading to hypokalemia.
Right. And the chronic effect of all that high cortisol is tissue breakdown. Their skin is thin, fragile, and they develop these large purple stretch marks, or strays. They're prone to osteoporosis and bone fractures because cortisol leaches calcium from the bones.
And they're also chronically immune suppressed.
Yes, due to the high steroid levels, making infection a constant threat.
So nursing management focuses on managing the excess and reducing risk.
Sodium and fluid restriction is essential to manage the hypertension and edema. We strictly monitor for signs of infection, and we support the patient through what can be profound body image changes. And if the cause is medication exogenous Cushing's, the most critical nursing intervention is teaching the patient that the steroid must be tapered slowly.
Because abrupt discontinuation will throw them immediately into an Addisonian crisis.
The acute shock we just talked about, absolutely. You've just covered a massive amount of life-critical knowledge. So now let's run through 5 concept blocks. These are quick review questions designed to test your priority setting. Don't just answer. Think about why the answer is the priority.
Okay, concept block 1, starting with COPD. Your patient, a chronic CO2 retainer, has an SpO2 of 86% and is restless. You have standing orders for a nasal cannula. How should you apply the oxygen? Take a second to think.
The answer is, titrate the oxygen to the lowest effective dose, usually 1 to 2 liters per minute, and target an SpO2 of 88 to 92%. The rationale is that giving high-flow oxygen, like a non-rebreather, risks removing their hypoxic respiratory drive, which could cause acute respiratory failure. You have to be cautious with CO2 retainers.
Concept block 2, related to CHF. Your patient gained 3 pounds overnight. What should be your immediate next nursing action?
The answer is, assess for other signs of fluid overload, like lum crackles or JVD, and contact the provider immediately with the weight data. The rationale here is that daily weight gain is the earliest and most reliable indicator of fluid retention, often preceding other classic signs, and it demands an urgent change in their diuretic therapy.
Concept block 3, electrolytes and the ECG. You see a prominent U wave on the ECG of a patient who's taking both furosemide and digoxin.
Yeah.
What is your immediate concern?
The answer is hypokalemia. The U wave is the classic ECG sign of low potassium, which is a common side effect of potassium-wasting diuretics like furosemide. And furthermore, hypokalemia significantly increases the risk of life-threatening digoxin toxicity.
Concept block 4, the DKA treatment sequence. You have orders for IV fluids, IV insulin, and potassium replacement. Which one is the absolute first intervention?
The answer is 4V fluid resuscitation using normal saline. The rationale is that the patient in DKA is severely volume depleted. Correcting the dehydration to restore perfusion and tissue oxygenation is the life-saving step that precedes all the other metabolic corrections. Fluids before insulin, always.
Yeah, last one, concept lock 5, the endocrine distinction, a patient who is receiving their daily glucocorticoid replacement reports feeling intensely sick with nausea, abdominal pain, and they appear confused and hypotensive. What emergency are you preparing to treat?
The answer is Addisonian crisis or acute adrenal crisis. The rationale is that any physical stressor, like an illness or injury in a patient with Addison's or a patient on chronic steroids who abruptly stop them, requires immediate administration of high-dose IV steroids or stress dosing to prevent circulatory shock.
That was a tremendous amount of ground. But if you focus on these three core takeaways, you will master physiological adaptation on the NCLEX. So takeaway one, priority interventions are based on sequence. In DKA, fluids always, always precede insulin. In hyperkalemia, the sequence is stabilization first with calcium gluconate, then shifting with insulin glucose, then elimination with chi-xylate or dialysis. And in anaphylaxis, epinephrine IM is the absolute first action to protect the airway and the blood pressure.
Takeaway two, the critical comparisons must be automatic. You have to know the difference in symptoms between left versus right CHF, pulmonary congestion versus systemic edema, and internalize that endocrine pattern. Addison's is low and salty, so low blood pressure, high potassium, they crave salty foods, they have bronze skin, while Cushing's is high and puffy high blood pressure, low potassium, fluid excess, and a moon face.
And takeaway three, VAP prevention is mandatory and specific. Never forget the non-negotiables for mechanical ventilation, HOB, elevated 30 to 45 degrees, meticulous oral care with chlorhexidine, subglottic suctioning, and sedation vacations. These are test gold, because they directly impact patient outcomes.
And finally, as you encounter the complexity of multi-system failure like sepsis and MODS, just remember that the true nursing challenge is managing the underlying perfusion failure. Your constant, dedicated vigilance of two key metrics, the lactate level and ensuring adequate urine output, is the measure of whether your resuscitation is truly effective. Understanding why those metrics guide therapy is the difference between passing the exam and truly practicing safe nursing.
We know this material is overwhelming. I mean, physiological adaptation feels like a mile-wide, mile-deep ocean of facts, and it is completely normal to feel stressed by the volume. But you don't pass the NCLEX by memorizing lists. You pass by connecting with the concepts and understanding the why behind the priority action.
Focus on the sequence. Understand the compensation mechanisms like Cosmol breathing, and use the priority setting framework we reviewed today. When you can link hyperkalemia to renal failure and then renal failure to anemia, the facts stop floating independently and they start making logical sense.
And if you are struggling to make these difficult comparisons stick like differentiating Addison's bronze skin from Cushing's striae, that's where our unique resources come in. This entire deep dive is brought to you by nursingnotes.org's ConceptCast, and we specialize in memory retention. We are the first and only resource that uses music-powered learning, employing catchy songs and mnemonics to help you memorize those confusing high-yield facts faster than traditional methods.
Our system also integrates AI tools that continuously test you on critical distinctions, reinforcing memory exactly where you need it most. Our tools are built by nurses who have been through the NCLEX journey and know exactly how to turn overwhelming information into usable, life-saving knowledge.
Go master those critical concepts, know your priorities cold, and we'll catch you on the next deep dive. You got this.